hear him howling around your kitchen door.
Well, good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this 31st day of October. Happy Halloween for all of those of you who celebrate. It's a lovely day. If you are dressed and out and having fun. I don't know how it's going to be fair weather-wise for the trick-or-treaters, but, you know, they'll figure it out. There's a lot of indoor activities. I know there's a lot of trunk-or-treating. Did you ever go trunk-or-treating?
A few times.
Yeah. And
that seems like cheating.
No, see,
not playing with fire.
Yeah, so, do you know what started trunk-or-treating?
Well, I do know, so I'm from Troy, and my mother works in the public school, so we had a area where it's less fortunate, so we had a centralized place where they were able to have a safe place to trick-or-treat, and I helped
out. Oh, that's very nice.
Now you made me feel bad.
Okay. We're talking to Bradley. I'll introduce all of our special guests in just a moment. But so they have the trunk-or-treating, which is, and I agree fundamentally with Judith, it's sort of cheating, but it is nice that people can go and
have it
without
work
concern.
You got to work for those Kit Kat bars.
And but we often live in rural areas, and it's not, you know, it's like 8 miles between. If you're out in our way, Aaron, it's, you know, you're
sure
you got on the
it's a half a mile walk between houses.
Somebody shows up at my house, I'm calling Child Protective Services. I mean, well, like, I live on Route 2.
That's exactly it. Well, anyway, hopefully it'll be a lovely night for all of you who are celebrating, and have a great day. We're going to be playing some Halloween-themed music. We have a playlist online, wamc.org/roundtable, and you can check it out there. Some cool tunes that have been selected for your listening enjoyment. Speaking of listening enjoyment, we have three wonderful guests plus three special guests, plus a lot of topics to talk about, so we will get right to it. We welcome senior fellow and faculty member in the Center for Advancement of Public Action, president of Beyond Plastics, former EPA at Bennington College is what I meant to say, former EPA regional administrator appointed by President Obama and co-author of the book, The Problem with Plastic. She's holding up a copy to your radio now.
Pre-order.
It comes out December 2nd from our friends at the New Press. So there we go. It's out. It's official. The reviews are in. They're fantastic. So we're very excited to have that out in the world. Good morning, Judith. How are you?
Good morning. And after this show, we're going to pre-tape your book show. You're going to interview me.
Right.
I'm so A, grateful, and B, excited that this is my first, like, grown-up real interview about the book with Joe Donahue. So I'm grateful for that. And then after that, I'm running to Amtrak to catch the train to New York to spend the weekend knocking on doors for this little-known young upstart candidate who's running for mayor in New York City. I don't know if you've heard of this up here.
We'll be
knocking on doors.
We talked about the New York City mayoral race at some length yesterday in the program.
Missed it.
And Zoran Mamdani is the candidate you're referring to, and running against Curtis Sliwa and Andrew Cuomo, and it should be a very interesting race. And I was going to say, I mean, the polls are all over the place, but depending on what poll you look at, he's either winning by 10 points, 12 points, or 14 points. So,
yeah, it's looking good, but he makes the point, you know, the polls are often wrong. And so he's got actually 90,000 volunteers. So I think there's like a large number of us who have adult children in Brooklyn, and we really just want to spend time with our kids. So we're going down to knock on doors with them and support the candidate.
That sounds good. Well, enjoy. Have fun with that. We also welcome the CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan. Good morning, Heather. How are you?
I am well, and I am here proud to be here with a fellow Troyalty. I also lived in Troy. I lived on Pine Woods, two houses down from this frat house that has this amazing haunted house every year. So there'd be a line of like 100 kids waiting to go in. And I would go through bags and bags of candy. And one time I ran out and I actually gave out fortune cookies because it was the only thing I could find like that was wrapped in my house. And I was terrified my house was going to get toilet papered or something. But people were like, cool, because it was the older kids who showed up.
Why is a great idea? I think a fortune cookie is a great idea.
Well, it was all I had. I had a cookie jar full of them because I used to order sushi all the time from Okinawa, which is really good, by the way.
Better than handing out broccoli.
Yeah, or raisins. Who's that person, right? Like, that's the one it gets around. That's the raisin house. Forget it. I'm not going there.
Apples.
That's right. Did you want to comment on the? I thought you were joking.
I was gonna ask, where did you get so many fortune cookies that you could hand them out when you ran out of candy?
I had three little boys.
Okay.
And we ordered sushi at least once a week and probably Chinese once a week, and nobody ever ate the fortune cookies. So I had a cookie jar full of them.
Why?
Because we would order so much food by the time you get to the cookie phase.
Because there's days not too far from that you could just go up to a house and say, give me candy.
Right.
Fair.
Siena University Professor of Economics Aaron Pasitti is with us. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning. I am embarrassed to admit that I've already eaten two of the bags of candy that my wife Allison bought that we're going to give out with a friend later in the village where they do have trick-or-treating. In the village of Cambridge.
Yeah.
So I've already depleted the candy inventory by 40%, so I need to stop and buy more candy. Maybe I'll just stop by your house and grab some fortune cookies.
Yeah, there you go.
I still have the same cookie jar moved with me out to Brunswick. It's pretty cool.
I enjoyed trick-or-treating when I was younger, but what I really missed was, I'm kind of embarrassed to admit this, Mischief Night.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that was where the action
was.
Trick-or-treating is like the denouement.
Night, I know in some places.
Devil's Night,
Devil's
I think,
Night,
in Michigan.
Also known as Juvie.
Yes.
Well, the interesting thing is, and how long ago did you give away the
stale fortune cookies?
I've lived in Brunswick for over 10 years, but this was more than 10 years ago.
Because I'm just saying, I bet if Aaron were to go out and get cookies today, they were probably made on the same day.
Probably, yeah.
I'm sure there's a lot of preservatives
I will say there is an overabundance of the weird chocolate ones, which I just don't get. Like,
that's
the chocolate
not real.
Fortune cookies. Half the time, it's not even a fortune.
No,
it's just some like saying, you know.
Yeah.
I want a fortune. I want
just
like,
be on time. Well, that's right.
not a
fortune,
right?
It's like look out for a Buick. That's
right.
What I want to know. We have three incredible students who are with us who are all econ students, econ majors at Siena University in Loudonville, New York. It's my father's alma mater. It's a place of great love in my heart, and I thank you all for being here. Let me introduce them to you. We spoke a moment ago to Bradley Fraser, and hello, Bradley. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm well. What year are you in?
This is my third year at Siena, but I'll be graduating in 3 years.
Oh, good for you. And what will you graduate? What degree will you graduate with?
I'll graduate with a BA in economics.
Okay. And are you the hope, the dream, what you would like to do with life after Siena University?
These are the hard-hitting questions, but maybe work in Albany in the state legislature, maybe go to law school, still up in the air.
All right. I think we have several people in this room who could talk to you about that career path. Very nice to meet you. Thank you very much for being here. We also welcome Jake Nass with us. Hello, Jake. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm well. It's good to have you here.
Yeah, good to be here.
Tell me your story.
Yeah, I'm a junior also, but I'm not weird like Brad. I'm graduating next year as a senior.
Let me just write that down. Not weird like Brad.
Or not bright like Brad.
Exactly.
Fair enough. Yeah, similar.
Don't take a shot at Brad.
Thinking some career in politics, you know, similar million-dollar question, what you want to do. A lot of options out there. But
now, what do you find the allure of politics to be?
I don't know. I think it's tough right now for it to be attractive. A lot of bickering between the sides. But, I think it's nice to be able to go out there and kind of stand up for causes you believe in. You know what I'm saying? Like, there's certain policies you're passionate about, and I think it'd be nice to try to go out there and make somewhat of a difference.
I'm not putting you on the spot, so feel free to just wave off this question. But do you find yourself politically active now?
I try to be, yeah. So I've actually volunteered on I'm from Maine. So I have
Where in Maine?
Kennebunk area, southern Maine. Maine. Yep.
Yeah.
So
I knew a president from there, yeah.
Yep, there is, yep. I've met him, yeah. I actually that was a lot of my work. So I have spent some of my summers actually mostly property maintenance, but working for the presidential family. And I think that's where I really got into the politics and wanting to go down that route.
All right. So now this is all I want to talk about. This is the problem with doing these little interviews. So the Bush estate there, and is mostly used now by what was his name who didn't win?
Jeb
Bush.
He actually, I would say, spends the least time there.
Oh, okay.
But all the family still has a presence there for sure.
Oh, nice.
They all love Maine. They love spending time there in the summer.
Yeah, and the former president, George W. Bush.
Yeah, he enjoys it there still.
That's nice.
Time there.
I have a question. Do they recycle?
They do, actually. Yeah. I do the recycling for them. But,
obviously no NDA.
Very.
That's good.
No NDA. Very, very nice. Natalie Zhu is with us. And Natalie, it's a pleasure to have you here in Studio A this morning. Tell us about your path and what is what brought you to Siena and where you will go from there.
So I'm a sophomore. I'm in my first semester sophomore year. I don't have as much of an interesting story, I think, but
all stories are interesting.
Yes, I think, yeah. So I'm actually a finance major, minoring in econ, but I'm still in the same area, kind of deciding where I want to go. Again, like we talked about, that million-dollar question of what exactly I want to do for the rest of my life. Not quite sure, but definitely interested in economics in general, and then figuring out where I want to go from there.
You always were good with numbers and figuring that.
Yeah. I enjoyed numbers throughout high school, so it kind of flowed into economics once I got to college.
And where's home base?
Niskayuna.
Oh, good. All right. So Troy, Niskayuna, and Maine. Very nice. We have our various areas of our listening area covered. Good morning, all. We welcome you as well. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. And we are very happy that you are with us. So the story, tail out of school, but I had an event last night, so I sent out topics early, and then I wrote to the group and I said, well, if anything breaks over the next several hours, I'll send an updated one when I get home late. And then I felt compelled to send the nuclear testing story.
That let us sleep very well last night.
Yes. So I thought about it and I said, well, we can't go without that one, can we? So President Trump's unexpected declaration on Thursday that he was ordering the U.S. military to resume nuclear testing prompted visions of a return to the worst days of the Cold War, when the United States, Russia, and China were regularly detonating new weapons, first in the atmosphere and outer space, then underground. This from the New York Times. Let me just interrupt that coverage by just saying, so, I mean, the optics yesterday were the president meets in China with President Xi. They have a meeting, by all accounts from both the both Xi's side and Trump's side, say was a productive, good meeting, and that deals were made. And then you come out and you say, oh, and by the way, we're going to resume our nuclear testing.
On the plane during a pull-aside.
Right.
With his head poking out from the cabin.
That's right. So it was an era, of course, of terrifying threats, counter threats, of dark visions of Armageddon and theories of deterrence by mutually assured destruction. That age supposedly ended with the arrival of the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty that nations agreed to in the mid-1990s. But not enough of the signatories ratified it for the treaty to formally come into force. Its objective was to starve the arms race by cutting off new tests and the cycle of retaliation they engendered. Mr. Trump has now revived the debate inside the national security community over whether to break the tradition of observing that treaty, which some of his former aides have argued impedes the country's ability to demonstrate peace through strength. On Air Force One, returning from Korea, the president told reporters he had made the call because of all the other countries conducting nuclear tests. Quote, "We've halted it years, many years ago," Mr. Trump said, referring to the fact that the last U.S. explosive test of a nuclear weapon was 1992 during the George H.W. Bush administration, who has a lovely house maintained by Jake. But Trump went on to say, with others doing testing, I think it is appropriate that we do also. Why not join in on the fun, right, Judith?
Well, there aren't other countries doing the testing. There has not been nuclear testing for decades. I mean, I think this has always been my greatest fear. There's a long list of concerns with this federal administration, but I've always worried about them getting into nuclear weapon debates. And the only thing more terrifying is that he'll be consulting with Fox Weekend host Pete Hegseth to make this decision. So there's no justification for this. This doesn't make any sense whatsoever. But he doesn't say things by mistake. Something is going on. And the UN process doesn't work, and the president doesn't listen to other people. And this is a quite serious situation.
So I think Judith's right in terms of the severity of this, but the timing of this falls into a very well-worn part of the Trump playbook, and that is create an enormous distraction when something else is bad is going to happen. And what bad is going to happen is the SNAP benefits and the Affordable Care Act premiums going up. I'm not saying he's not serious about this, but this is a great way to get the looming hunger crisis and healthcare crisis off of the front pages. So when you surround yourself with, you know, when dictators and strong leaders surround themselves with loyalists and yes men and yes women, they don't tell them what they need to know. So I think the Trump administration was completely ignorant about how much the SNAP benefits affect people from poor, white, rural districts that voted for MAGA. And now they're only belatedly coming to this acknowledgement. The fact that when the open enrollment for the Affordable Care Act starts tomorrow, that a lot of, again, people from poor white rural regions are going to see their premiums go up. I think it finally hit them that they kind of made a mistake. And in order to shift the view away from that mistake, you, no pun intended, do something bombastic and start talking about nuclear.
It's a pretty intense shift.
But of course it is. Is that surprising at this point?
No, but still, I think we often hear Trump say things and part of your coping mechanism is, oh, you know, he's just talking. It's never going to happen. I think this is pretty serious. I don't disagree with you. It's the timing is curious mm-hmm. as SNAP benefits expire at midnight tonight. And don't forget, you know, the House has been closed because they don't want to swear in
that was the other
member of Congress to vote on the Epstein files. That's probably motivating them more than even SNAP.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, for people who work on nuclear disarmament policy, this is a really, really serious moment.
Heather.
So a couple things. First, apparently the announcement, although it was made after the meeting, the decision was made before the meeting with President G, right? So I think there's probably not a relationship there, but I do think that it is directly related to the fact that there was information that Russia had engaged in testing of very complex vehicles for nuclear weapons, which, you know, if you have a short attention span, you might hear as testing nuclear weapons rather than testing nuclear weapons vehicles. Also, we're within 100 days of a treaty with Russia that is going to expire that limits the number of nuclear weapons that we have. So I would think, like, if you were really thinking about, is Russia, you know, escalating its threat, what can I do to make to set them back? And he was very in his statement, he did say that our testing will be the same amount of testing as other, you know, parties to these treaties. Right. So that's Russia. I'm sorry, but that's...
But there hasn't been nuclear testing.
No, there hasn't.
North Korea had one test in 2017.
Right, but Russia has been testing very advanced vehicles for nuclear weapons, the smaller, like, battlefield nuclear weapons, not apples to apples at all.
Do you think for Ukraine? Is that why they're doing it?
Well, maybe. I mean, maybe they're just projecting, right? Maybe they're just, like... It's just a different version of shirtless Putin riding around on a horse, right? Oh, and look at my fancy vehicles that can blow things up, you know. Sorry, I shouldn't mock him so blatantly, but you know,
I'm fine with that.
These are people who love to show might. You know, we love, you know, we, but our current president loves big fancy military parades. He likes shows of might. And if there is, you know, even a suggestion by Putin that they're going to escalate on the nuclear front, I mean, I think Trump would not be able to resist saying something back to try and say, well, you know, my muscles are bigger than yours. But I mean, that's what I think this is personally, and I don't think it has. I mean, it has the added benefit of, look over here. There's a new shiny thing to be mad about. But I do think that all of it is very much related to what's going on with Putin.
The American arsenal includes roughly 3,700 warheads, with about 1,700 of them currently deployed, according to the Federation of American Scientists. The group, which has long scrutinized the highly classified topic, recently updated its estimates. Nuclear weapons can be carried on warplanes like the B-2 or B-52, launched from missiles and silos on U.S. territory, or heaved from rockets on submarines. The United States does not have the most nuclear bombs in the world, as Mr. Trump incorrectly stated yesterday. That distinction belongs to the Russian Federation.
Mm-hmm.
Which, again, mm-hmm. to your point.
This seems to also run in contrast to the, like, America first agenda. Like, we're not going to get involved in global conflict and, you know, we're going to end these endless wars. And it's, I mean, this is Cold War number two. I mean, this has the potential to start Cold War number two and an arms race, which could be a huge boom for defense contractors. But this also does seem to be escalating international tensions, which is something he campaigned on de-escalating, about how he's going to end these wars in 24 hours, and now he's talking about ramping it up.
You do wonder what impact this is going to have on the talks with allies.
And the Nobel Peace Prize that he really wants.
Yes, there's there's that, too. One other thing I wanted to make mention of, this also from the Times. The last underground explosive blast at the Nevada test site occurred on September 23rd, 1992. Its power was reported quite small, a third of Hiroshima bombs. And no public information seems to exist on the test's purpose. I assume after 30 plus years, we probably won't know. And nor do I think, if anything happens in the near future, will we know about that either. We'll know about the test. We may not know as to the reason why. Although maybe we will.
He's not good at keeping secrets.
No, I know. That's what I mean. Yeah.
And it was interesting, the disconnect. Trump saying that, you know, the goal, we're starting these nuclear tests because other countries are doing it. And then J.D. Vance said something about, like, we want to make sure they work.
Oh, my God.
And there seems to be a disconnect about, like, it's very clear the rest of the administration probably didn't know this announcement was coming, given the very disjointed, and everybody's trying to get on the same page at the last minute. So this is clearly a unilateral decision, and now everybody else in the administration is scrambling to figure out how to position themselves so they're all on the same page. This is kind of a tough thing to get on the same page about.
So I'm just going to elaborate a little bit because I sort of mangled what I was saying about Russia, but they very recently declared that they had tested two exotic delivery vehicles for nuclear weapons, a nuclear-powered cruise missile and an undersea torpedo that could cross the Pacific and strike the west coast of the United States. And both are designed to evade American missile defenses. So I think that is what prompted this announcement by President Trump. Yeah, that's my guess. They are testing vehicles, not weapons.
But Trump is supposed to have this relationship with Putin. So why don't they just talk as opposed to having...
Because they're guys. Come on.
Yeah, they're dangerous guys. Yeah.
They're not talking about feelings.
There are a certain type of guy. Let's not lump all dudes together.
Right, no. You get a pass. Okay.
Thank you.
Autocrats.
I do like the Vance thing, though. We don't know if it works or not, so let's just blow it up and see if it works. Like, the, you know, that's a...
There's a good argument to not do it besides the green light for other people to re-engage in testing. And that's... There is a long history of espionage around nuclear weapons. It would be... probably safe to assume that that would be all the espionage would be resurrected because we have much more advanced nuclear capacity than anybody else. We risk losing that edge if we start, going through the process again and giving an opportunity for, some spy to get the information or for someone to get bribed or whatever. So I think you're better off not testing if you want to keep the stuff secure, besides the added value of not giving a green light for everybody else to go test.
Brad, Jake, Natalie, anybody want in on this particular conversation?
Sure. I believe that the United States shouldn't be a reactive country. We're supposed to have the greatest nuclear scientists and all sorts of that stuff. But I don't believe that we should be reacting to the actions of Russia in this capacity. We should be setting the tone of making comments that this nuclear testing will be viewed carefully with Russia and will respond accordingly, as opposed to starting the fire of, we're going to jump the gun and we're going to start nuclear testing when it might not necessarily be... needed. It's just an unnecessary step forward in such a dangerous game to play.
Great point.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say I agree with Brad. I think if these other nations were truthfully testing nuclear warheads, then I think we'd have a completely different discussion, and we should be testing, as we always, I think, should try to be a step ahead of our competitors. But with the current state where Russia is only testing the vehicles, I think we should definitely not be reinstating our nuclear program, and that we should definitely be trying to get peace talks done and trying to reconnect with Putin and, try to de-escalate it before it ramps up.
All right. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll move on to other subjects. We welcome all of you. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. 42 minutes past 9 o'clock on this Friday morning of Halloween. We welcome your input. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll return right after this short break.
When you come along and that freaks me out, I will fight Dracula's wedding. Terrified.
Well, good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Friday, the 31st of October. And I don't know. I guess it's just if you're going to have Halloween, it's cool to have it on a Friday. And we welcome all of you to the proceedings on this morning. We welcome you as always. We have Judith Enck with us. Heather Mulligan and Aaron Pasitti, plus three of his incredibly brilliant students, Siena University econ majors, Bradley Frazier, Jake Nass, and Natalie Zhu. And they will pop in from time to time as well. I love having students in the studio. It is so much fun. You guys are really, all of our panelists are wonderful, but the vibe level goes up higher when you've got the students in the room. I don't know if you feel that or not.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's really cool. All right, let's go to something new and see what else is making news. Well, why don't we, since we have a lot of econ majors in here, let's talk about the Fed. The Federal Reserve cut interest rates by a quarter point for the second time this year. Investors lowered the probability of a cut at the Fed's December meeting after Jerome Powell, the central bank's chair, said that there were strongly differing views on what to do next. So there are some takeaways from the meeting, but if you look at this, after another quarter point cut, interest rates set by the Fed are now below 4% for the first time since late 2022. Jerome Powell said the reduction moved the Fed's policy settings closer to a, quote, neutral level that does not stimulate growth or slow it down. That suggests there may not be that much more scope for the central bank to cut interest rates further. Then, room for debate. This remains a very divided Fed, as evidenced by the fact that two officials cast dissenting votes in opposite directions. One wanted a bigger half-point cut, another wanted no cut at all. The split stems not only from divergent forecasts about the economy, but also risk tolerances around allowing the labor market to weaken or inflation to stay elevated. And then we go to the general uncertainty when it comes to Jerome Powell. Powell made clear that the disagreements extended to the path forward for policy with a cut at the December meeting, not a foregone conclusion in light of strongly differing views about how to proceed. The Fed chair also said that a lack of official government statistics as a result of the ongoing shutdown could make the central bank more cautious about further cuts. If you're going to base something on data, you need the data. It helps. All right, Aaron, take it away.
So the actual policy decision, the quarter point rate cut, was not much of a surprise because the Federal Reserve has two jobs. It's called the dual mandate, and that is to set interest rates to maintain full employment, so to keep unemployment rates low so that every worker who wants a job can get a job, that keeps the labor market strong, wage growth high. But at the same time, the second part of their dual mandate is the price stability mandate, which is to keep inflation rates low and stable. So those two objectives are often in conflict with one another. And when the Fed raises interest rates, it's designed to slow the economy and fight inflation. When the Fed lowers interest rates, it's designed to stimulate the economy and encourage hiring and borrowing. So what we've seen over the past, really since the spring, has been an enormous slowdown in hiring. That, you know, since April of 2025, for the Liberation Day, where Trump liberated us from economic prosperity and certainty, job growth has averaged 29,000 a month. We need about 150,000 jobs added per month just to keep up with population growth. So what is clear is that the weakness in the labor market, even though the unemployment rate is low, job growth has essentially stalled to about zero. Long-term unemployment is on the rise, where about a quarter of all unemployed workers have been unemployed for more than half a year. There's been this alarming rise in unemployment rates for Black workers, in addition to recent college graduates. So you're starting to see some cracks without, you know, a spike in the unemployment rate. And this is a self-inflicted crisis that the Trump administration created with the uncertainty surrounding tariff and economic policy, that tariffs on, tariffs off, tariffs on, tariffs even bigger, tariffs off. So businesses respond to that uncertainty by just stopping hiring. They're not laying off workers at alarming levels, but nor are they hiring. So you're seeing this freeze in the labor market. So Powell and the Fed are taking a measured approach to lower rates to try to keep the labor market from contracting. But by lowering interest rates, you also have the potential to exacerbate the inflation problem, which we're starting to see increased signs of due to the tariffs. In April of 2025, the inflation rate was 2.3%, very close to the Fed's target. And since then, it's risen to 3%. And that increase isn't broad-based. It's primarily focused on goods that are imported, so like appliances, furniture, apparel, electronics, and a variety of other goods. So if you put those two things together, the word I want people to keep in mind for the next year is stagflation. Stagflation is the combination of economic stagnation, slow hiring, rising unemployment, and slowing growth, coupled with rising inflation. And we haven't seen that in the U.S. economy since the 1970s, and it inflicts enormous pain because not only is the cost of living going up and that erodes people's purchasing power, when you have that erosion in purchasing power happening at the same time workers are losing their jobs, it's essentially a double whammy. And the Fed can't fight both of those things at the same time. So, unsurprisingly, you're starting to see this division within the Fed, where people are some governors are arguing for more rate cuts, primarily Trump's lapdog, and that's what I'm calling these people at this point, lapdogs. Stephen Moran wanted to cut interest rates even further. That defies Econ 101 analysis, which is if inflation has increased by 7 percentage points in the span of 5 months, you don't lower interest rates. That's going to exacerbate the inflation problem. But since he's Trump's lapdog, he's trying to make it so that the unemployment rate doesn't go up. Well, if you do that, you're going to sacrifice higher inflation. So the Fed is operating in uncharted territory for a number of reasons. The uncertainty surrounding tariff policy and whether businesses should engage in these long-term investment projects where they have to import Chinese steel and Canadian aluminum and Canadian lumber, not knowing what tariff rates are going to be next week, let alone 5 years from now. You also have the Fed operating in the dark because with the government shutdown, they're not getting data releases. We haven't seen what the new job numbers were for October because they weren't released because the government was shut down. So you have this enormous uncertainty, both in terms of how the economy is performing, what the Fed is thinking. And usually when that happens, the best response to uncertainty is to do nothing. So I wouldn't be surprised if the Fed doesn't cut rates at all in their December meeting. And there's other aspects that are worth pointing out. And Jamie Dimon, the CEO of J.P. Morgan, had a great quote. And I'll get to that quote in a minute. But what you're seeing is the rise of auto loan delinquencies and defaults. You're starting to see an increase in corporate delinquencies and defaults, particularly in the shadow banking sector. And what Jamie Dimon said, well, if you see one cockroach, there's probably more. So that this beginning of these bankruptcies and defaults are another sign of weakness in the economy that's not particular to the labor market, but is now starting to spread into the corporate and banking sector. So we are in very strange and very uncertain times that make monetary policy decisions exceptionally important for maintaining stability. But it's worth pointing out that this is a self-inflicted crisis, that this didn't need to be this way.
So I have two questions. I'm going to get to the other panel members, but and they may, they're just for, one's for clarifications, one is just being nitpicky. But the clarification one is that if you are going to, for example, when you talk about having this data when it comes to jobs numbers, And we don't know that because of the shutdown, but also the president fired the person who the head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So when you mentioned the other member of the Fed who didn't want to screw around with the jobless rate and causing inflation, then if you're making the numbers up, and I don't know that they are, but I don't know that they're not. So does that figure into it?
Yep, that adds to the uncertainty. Like not getting the data releases is one thing. There are like ADP, the payroll processor. They release their monthly employment reports, and economists track. You know that they have ways to say, okay, well, if the ADP report is this, then we can expect job growth to be this. There's data on that. Google has their, I believe it's Google, they have their billion price index, which tracks the prices of a billion goods. So even with a government shutdown, there are private sources that provide approximations, but government data is the gold standard. So when you factor in having, I forget his name, the new commissioner of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, who is really an economic hack that no economist takes seriously, people have tried to replicate his analysis.
That's
on
his name.
The hack, but not Gene Smart. Those numbers are just, nobody's going to believe them. And it's not just the Fed that's going to be affected by this. How are firms like JP Morgan and Goldman Sachs that extend credit to private businesses? How is Trustco Bank? How will KeyBank respond to trying to operate in an environment where the data you're getting, you know, is not true? How can they set interest rates to ensure that they remain profitable? How can businesses borrow so that they can be ensured that they can get a positive rate of return? All that does is add to the uncertainty and the confusion.
Okay, so uncertainty and confusion. So my second question, and then we'll take a break and we'll come back and we'll talk to everybody about this. But my second question is, how do, when we think about, And maybe all of your students can chime in on this as well, because maybe this is just like something that is totally ingrained in the study of economics. But roughly, what is the timeline from the time that I go into a store, or I want to buy a car, or I want to buy a house, or I want to do anything substantial, and my decision is impacted by what the rates are there, to then seeing that reflected within the Fed, within the numbers, within the interest rates, and so forth that we see?
That can take about 6 to 18 months before Fed decisions fully transmit.
That seems a long time.
It is a long time. So this is why getting policy important. This is why getting policy correct is important, because there's this lag. So the decision the Fed makes today is going to affect us in mid-2026. So when the Fed's just guessing of like, well, we're operating with limited data, there's this enormous uncertainty. E.J. Antoni will be the new commissioner of the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Maybe EJ stands for economic joker. He is not respected in the economics community. He is raised by the Heritage Foundation. He's going to be a lapdog. This all is going to confound and make people's lives far more stressful. And it's going to be an issue and a problem that's of the Trump administration's own doing.
Okay, so one more question, and then we'll really go to a break.
Mm-hmm.
Why would you want to sow that uncertainty? And the sense of why would you want to? You've used the term now twice about a self-inflicted wound.
Yeah.
Then why?
Dictators tend to thrive with uncertainty. That when you cast doubt on the credibility of the Federal Reserve, when you cast doubt on the credibility of the news media, when you cast doubt on the credibility of this institution, the Department of Justice or whatever, it allows them to consolidate their power, because who do people turn to when there's times of uncertainty? Big, strong leaders who ride horses shirtless. And I think a big part of that uncertainty, you can tell I'm in a mood. This is problematic. But
Heather planted the seed.
I think the issue with uncertainty is that Trump is interested in a dominance display. He doesn't have advisors telling him this is bad for the economy. And when you create your own crisis, it's easy to solve your own crisis, just like he did with the tariff talks over the last week with China. You create a problem, and then you come to the rescue by fixing the problem you created, and you come out looking better, even though everybody else is paying the cost of that.
Five other people who would like to jump in and talk about this as well. Maybe you're going to be added to the list. We'd love to hear from you. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. We'll be right back after news.
I should stay away, but what can I do? I hear your name and I'm aflame.
Flame of desire.
That only your kiss.
Put out the fire.
That's a good one. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to hear from you, and we welcome you. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. I just need to determine from the judges, was that a cough or a sneeze?
That was a cough. The coffee went down the wrong pipe.
Then I won't say bless you. All right. Let's
bless you anyways, Eric.
Thank you.
That's right.
There's a million reasons I should be blessed.
Blessed at all you stand for. Okay. So we were talking before the break about the Fed. We were talking about the Fed meeting where the Fed rates, the Federal Reserve cut interest rates by a quarter point for the second time this year. And now the overall worry about the labor market. And Aaron Pasitti gave us a very impassioned and complete report, I think.
It was a two-credit class.
Yes, but I'm interested in others on your thoughts as to what we are looking at economically, Heather Moulton.
So a bunch of things. I always have questions for Aaron, and the one, and I've asked you this before, is there a difference between basic supply and demand caused inflation, right? Where you have an oversupply, say, of money or credit or ability to buy things versus inflation caused by a direct application of tariffs on top? Because to me, that's different in the sense that the ability to purchase things is now limited, right? Mm-hmm. The price goes up, the ability to purchase is limited. So it's very different than everyone has cash in their pocket.
Right.
And, you know, the ability to purchase things is limited because everybody else is buying the stuff, right? So that's a different, like, that's an economy kind of runaway train versus I think of tariffs as like a big giant roadblock, like it's slowing the train down. And I feel like that's sort of that difference is one of the, and maybe I'm giving too much credit, but that's one of the arguments why the president wants them to continue cutting rates, because he's like, okay, prices are go up, then what we need to do is give people more ability to buy, and that'll even things out. Even though, I mean, I think it's a very simplistic argument, and I'm not saying I agree with that, but I do think there's a difference. I think the real problem, in my opinion, is the uncertainty around the tariffs. So businesses, I talk to businesses all the time. They would tell you, still a difficult labor market, but they're not hiring as much because they don't know what is happening with the economy. So you don't have people doing big capital projects, borrowing a lot of money to build new stuff and expand because they don't know. Are we going to look at another 2008 Great Recession? And what is the bubble? Is there an AI bubble that's about to burst, right? So there's all of those moving parts. And when people don't know what's going to happen, you're like, oh, I'm just going to wait. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to wait. Right. And that causes stagflation, right? That's the slowdown in the economy. I also think there's another factor that I have not seen anyone discuss, and that is the acute workforce shortage when we came out of the Great Recession. You had a lot of people who decided to retire when their 401ks recovered. And we had very, very severe workforce issues for a period of time. That has alleviated somewhat. We do have some demographic issues, a smaller working age population, to be, you know, very particular. But because of that experience, I think many larger employers are slow to lay off. So I think that we're going to see if the, you know, the economic situation trends down, I think it's probably going to be a very quick letting go of a lot of people. Right. And you'll see a really strong negative labor market reaction. Now, I am not an economist, so I would like to know your view on everything I just said, because this is just me like overlaying what I hear from my members and then also particularly observations about the reaction post Great Recession, which I lived through at the Business Council in my current role, so I'm pretty familiar with how that looked.
I should have been taking notes because there were a lot of questions.
Sorry, yeah,
there. That's okay.
I do that.
prior to the 2000.com bubble crashing, most business cycles where the Fed stimulates the economy. By lowering interest rates, it generates growth.
Right.
You get low unemployment, rapid wage growth. That leads to rising inflation. The Fed raises rates, creates a recession with a cold shower. Inflation rates come down. And that was pretty much the cycle. Then beginning really with, it happened a little bit in 1990, but really with the dot-com bubble crashing in 2000-2001, the financial crisis in 2008, and COVID, that, you know, recessions today aren't caused by rising inflation where the Fed cracks down with higher interest rates. They're caused by asset bubbles bursting. They're caused by a pandemic in 2020. So, yes, there is a difference between normal, what economists call demand pull inflation, when the economy is growing and workers' wages go up, versus inflation that's caused by specific policies. The problem is that when these tariffs go into effect, they're going to, you know, raise prices, not for all good. I mean, for the goods and services that are affected by the tariffs, like automobiles, construction, agriculture, all of those prices will go up. But by lowering interest rates to keep the job market strong so consumers can afford those higher prices, is just going to create more broad-based inflation. And then you have a situation that we experienced in the late 60s and early 70s, where a little bit of modest inflation turns into a decade of double-digit inflation. So this is really, really risky. And again, you know, the goal of tariffs is arguably to bring back manufacturing jobs. You can't bring back jobs that have been outsourced where that whole entire production infrastructure has been gutted. You need subsidies. You need workforce training.
Right.
But some of the – we don't want to bring back low productivity, low wage jobs like apparel manufacturing. We should be thinking about 21st century manufacturing like renewable energy. Take your pick of what else. But, you know –
How about advanced manufacturing?
Advanced
technology?
Sure, right.
How about photonics? How about
semiconductors?
Yes, right.
Like, so I mean, all of the things that were in the CHIPS Act and the Inflation Reduction Act that Trump is undoing? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So the things we need to be subsidizing and trying to get off the ground, he's reducing the funding for exactly those programs.
Yeah,
so I feel bad. You know, I mean, there's the short-term effect, which is the uncertainty and, you know, are we going to go into a recession anytime soon? Nobody really knows. But then there's the longer-term stagnation and growth that could have some negative impacts on some people sitting in this room.
So, and I know Judith wants to talk, but I just one quick follow-up, which is
a rare thing.
There's, to me, one of the most startling things in looking at the rate over time, the federal rate, and they don't call it the rate, they call it the target, I think, or something.
Yeah.
It's not the inflation target, but it's the target rate. We're not at anywhere near an all-time high. I mean, we are basically right where we were as we went into the Great Recession.
Yeah.
So in 2008, like, this is not even 20. We're back to, I mean, there are granted historically low rates following the Great Recession in an attempt to correct, you know, take corrective action to offset some of the unemployment issues, right? But but we're kind of at a normal rate historically, even maybe a little low, right?
This is what Powell was talking. Joe mentioned this earlier when he was reading from the article, when Jerome Powell talked about the neutral rate of interest. It's an interest rate that is it neither stimulates nor contracts growth.
Right.
Coming out of the slump of the Great Recession and the financial crisis, interest rates needed to be zero because even that wasn't low enough to stimulate the economy.
Right.
Now we're kind of returning back to normal territory. So, yeah, even though interest rates are, you know, the target is 3.75 to 4% now, that's, you know, similar to what we saw through, you know, the late 90s, 2000s. So it's kind of a return to normal.
All right.
Judith.
Well, maybe we'll get into this more in the China discussion, but I think an underappreciated economic mistake is how the Trump administration is working overtime to destroy clean, renewable energy projects, because they have tremendous potential to improve air quality, reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and create local jobs. So not only has the Trump administration gotten rid of the tax credits for solar, but actually is attempting to cancel offshore wind projects. In Rhode Island, it was 90% constructed. I think it was called Revolution Wind. And thankfully, the Trump administration lost in court. But the whole energy policy of subsidizing fossil fuels and trying to utterly destroy solar, wind, geothermal makes obviously no environmental sense, but also no economic sense. But I think we can kind of summarize the policy, and I'm not implicating the Fed in this, but our current economic policy impact is the rich are getting richer, all right? Wall Street is doing very well. The poor are indeed getting poorer, and there are more poor people. The SNAP benefits expiring at midnight tonight is really going to have a devastating impact. 39% of the people who receive SNAP are children. The Obamacare increase in health insurance rates means a lot of people, if they have to choose between food, rent, mortgage, they're not going to pay for health care. So what happens, especially if you're older and you have a health problem, you delay getting health care, you stretch your prescription drugs so you take them every other day, you land in the hospital, which is much more expensive than having an affordable health care approach. And the tariffs are affecting people's consumer decisions and also small businesses having supply chain problems. Heather, you know this much better than I do, but this, you know, CNN has been interviewing small businesses affected by the tariffs. You know, some of the big businesses, they can absorb some of this additional cost. Most jobs are created from small businesses, and they are really, really struggling. They can have products that are made in the USA, but like one component isn't, and they can't get it, and therefore they are really struggling. But this economic policy is a disaster, and we need the Fed to do what they can. And I think the middle class, large numbers of middle class people, are now struggling with what low-income people, families trying to stretch budgets are dealing with.
Natalie, what do you think?
Sorry, we were talking about a lot, but I definitely agree that this is a little bit more of a dire situation than I think a lot of people are willing to admit. Like we talked about, stamp expiring is something that, you know, like we talked about earlier, the idea that the media is no longer possibly won't pay as much attention to it, but the truth is there are millions of Americans who do depend on it, and it comes down to like more of a humanitarian concern, and the idea that we're no longer worried about Wall Street, we're not worried about how stocks are performing, we're not worried about the NASDAQ, we're worried about people, like you said earlier, stretching prescription medication, people not receiving the health care, people going hungry, more people suffering on the streets. I think that is a more pressing issue than the idea of, you know, it is important to talk about about consumer decisions, right? But there's also people who no longer have the luxury of making the decision, oh, I'm going to buy a car. Oh, I can't buy a car anymore. You know, that's not within my budget. Or, you know, I can't afford my insulin, or, you know, I'm making the decision in between eating and rent.
Right.
So I think those are the more pressing conversations and issues that people aren't willing to have that we should be having.
Right. Certainly. And I think another like barrier that's occurring is people are putting out certain people in power are putting out statements that make generalized claims that don't necessarily capture the truth. We create stigmas against people in poverty saying maybe they're there for their own choices. However, looking at statistics, that just isn't the case. So when people almost feel ashamed of getting government assistance and SNAP and healthcare, and combining that with not being able to receive these things, it creates like such an incredible problem that, as one of the largest economies in the world, shouldn't be happening to a large percentage of our population.
What say you, Jake?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest issues with it is probably the moral dilemma. I think every human being in our country should have the right to eat. I mean, I think he's already been sued by, 25 states, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah, so already been sued by 25 states on, like, the moral ground of the situation. I think that's totally fair. I know I think Congresswoman from Massachusetts is very adamant on it, so I hope he doesn't win this, and I hope he gets sued and none of it will be able to go through, because it is scary. I mean, it's millions of Americans that aren't sure if they're going to wake up and be able to eat in the morning and the following days. And yeah, I think all this other stuff that's going on with the meetings in China and the nuclear weapons, and it should definitely be second class to the bigger issues in our local economy.
I mean, you can think of this as just the politics of cruelty. And this has Russell Vogt's fingerprints all over it. He's the director of the OMB, the Office of Management and Budget, where every spending decision Congress or the executive branch makes runs through OMB, if I understand that correctly. And his goal is to just dismantle the government and give as much power as possible to the executive branch. So he's been taking the battle axe to whatever he can get his hands on, whether it's federal staffing levels, whether the Consumer Financial Protection Board can operate, whether it's funding for USAID. He was directing Elon Musk during the Doge days. This has his fingerprints all over it. And as an appointed political representative, he doesn't care about getting reelected. He's concerned with having a political impact. But remember, there's a lot of people who are getting elected and have voters whose food stamps and insurance food stamp benefits will disappear and insurance premiums go up. And he doesn't care about them. Donald Trump does not care about them. They don't care about these people, even though these people are the MAGA base. So I think this is going to backfire if it goes on long enough. Because it's really going to be tough to escape the consequences of something of this magnitude.
So, I'm sorry. You should talk.
Yeah, and I was just going to add I'm very fortunate that I'm not going to be directly affected by some of these decisions like the SNAP cuts and such. But it's also a little bit more concerning to the problem that like there are issues with the Supreme Court and maybe favoring who appointed them or who's with them, and they I know, for example, Clarence Thomas even has mentioned the idea of this unilateral power, which is fundamentally not necessarily American. So it just makes the issue.
Well, the other parts of government, as you point out, are not functioning. So when cases go to the Supreme Court, they usually err with, you know, they decide in favor of the Trump position. So even one of you mentioned the 25 states that are the state attorneys general, including Tish James. So that's going to get Trump's attention just because our attorney general, Tish James, is involved in this. They will probably more likely win in court today. And then the Trump administration will likely appeal. There may be a stay. And then if it goes to the Supreme Court, you know, the cruelty seems to be the point. Now, Congress could do something, but the House of Representatives is closed. Talk about a long weekend. They have not met in a very, very long time. And I was listening to the other Morning Joe show this morning. This is my original Morning Joe.
Thank you.
But the other one that doesn't have as...
You're my Mika.
The other Morning Joe that doesn't have as many listeners. They were talking about how Trump is underwater with so many polls, especially since he... destroyed the East Wing. I'm still not over that. I will never be over that. But and so I'm thinking, so are House and Senate Republicans finally going to stand up to Trump because he's not polling well? I don't think they will because they are so afraid that he will line up a primary opponent for them. So we can't rely on Congress. We can't rely on the Supreme Court. So the way we're going to get out of this, I think, is ordinary people, you know, volunteering and donating to food pantries and soup kitchens and electing strong, principled leaders at the local level, trying to get our state legislature involved. But the federal government controls so much money. You can't... You know, if states try to step in and make up the difference on SNAP and access to health care, there's just not enough money to do that. So people will suffer.
So I wanted to just say a couple things because we're talking about
30 seconds.
Yeah, we're talking about the shutdown now. I just want to say all politics is local. I was in D.C. yesterday. I know that at the local level, the elected officials are very much House and Senate, Republican and Democrat, are feeling a lot of pressure. And this was brinksmanship. This is both sides have a problem here. You know, this is a continuing resolution that the Democrats have voted for in the past that they're refusing to vote for right now because of a very valid concern about health care premiums. They could do these things in parallel. They can do them separately. I think the calculus by the Republicans that they wouldn't get blamed for it is absolutely incorrect. And I think that they're probably going to come to an agreement next week.
Wicked, wicked witchcraft.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We have Judith Enk with us, Heather Mulligan, Aaron Pacitti. Aaron has brought three of his brilliant students from Siena University, Bradley Frazier, Jake Nass, and Natalie Zhu. And we welcome all of you to the program. And we also welcome our listeners who want to check in, write a note, share your thoughts. panel@wamc.org. Before we move on to other topics, which I do have actually an abundance of, is there anything else that somebody would like to say in regards to the Fed and the topic that we were discussing in regards to the economy?
One very quick thing is that, you can talk about the morality, the humanity, the cruelty of the not dedicating funds that have been set aside as in an emergency account to fund SNAP benefits. The economic impact this is going to have is going to be a major headwind to growth. So in addition to the cruelty of intentionally creating a hunger crisis, you're at the same time pushing the economy further into an economic crisis because these are people who are low income, and if they have to, you know, it's just going to reduce their spending on food. That's just going to be another headwind in addition to the government employees who aren't getting paid because of the shutdown. We're starting to see the storm clouds gathering, and none of them are gigantic just yet, but those storm clouds are gathering that are kind of suggesting that, you know, tougher economic times. And remember, what's that word I told everybody to remember?
Stagflation. Yeah.
Stagflation. That's like a right around the bend. With antlers, right?
Isn't that? No, that's the jackalope.
Oh, okay, thanks. I was, mixing them up.
Yeah, right, okay. Glad we got that straightened out.
That's the jackalope.
I just want to add one thing on the shutdown. This is, I lived through two federal government shutdowns when I worked at EPA, and the rules were very clear. Only essential workers could come in. And then we were told we couldn't actually do our work. We were just there in case there was an emergency. So I went into the EPA office in Manhattan every day. And I remember writing my Christmas cards and organizing my files because there couldn't send emails. You weren't allowed to look like you were working because of the government shutdown. This one is very disjointed. Some things get funded, some don't. And I think the real takeaway for me is the Trump administration will not tap into emergency funds to feed hungry people through SNAP, but yet we have ICE on the streets of American cities kidnapping people and causing tremendous harm. They're not just looking for people who have violated the law. There is data that so many people who are getting kidnapped have green cards, have not, the majority have done nothing wrong. So how is it that ICE can be on our streets terrorizing people, but we can't find the money for SNAP?
I do want to move on to other subjects. However, we do have some letters about all of the things that we have discussed in no particular order. We go to John, who says, we know that many of the products we buy are in the hands of few corporations. What part do these corporations have in keeping prices high?
Well, there's two ways of looking at that. There's been an enormous decrease in antitrust enforcement over the past 30 to 40 years. So market concentration in the U.S. is much larger, giving firms monopoly power to mark up prices. But it hasn't been a substantial inflation. It hasn't created a substantial inflation problem. The bigger issue is that a lot of these bigger firms can absorb the price increase because of the tariffs. They might lay off workers. They might, absorb some of those costs. It's the small businesses that are going to really face the brunt of this by not getting the products they need, laying off workers, and perhaps shuttering. So I wouldn't put the blame squarely on big businesses in creating the inflation crisis. I think it's far more complicated than I can discuss in the next 8 minutes or whatever.
I want to just weigh in a little bit, too, because I think it depends on what it is, in part.
Sure.
If you are talking about things like a cup of coffee, I mean, that's based on a commodity price. The business has very little control or ability to control a global market that, by the way, does not. I mean, there may be dominant figures in the coffee economy, but there's a lot of competition. And I would say that, there's a lot of bad things about the internet, but one good thing about the internet and one good thing about the ability of an individual small business to make themselves go viral on something like Instagram or finding, a celebrity who likes their thing, that really cuts into the ability of very, very large businesses to control market pricing in a lot of respects, especially for goods that are clothing, unique things.
Right.
Price is very important to large, large retail sellers. Very important. Sure. Being competitive price-wise, I mean, you just look at the difference between designer prices and knockoff prices of the same, essentially, mm-hmm. What looks to be like the same thing. And I'm sure designers would be really mad if I said they
are. I only buy the designer stuff.
Yeah, obviously, me too, right? We're all swagged out here today. So the internet has actually had an effect in the sense of limiting the ability of people to use their market dominance to raise prices. If anything, they're constantly looking for the people nipping at their heels, the small guys who are gaining big followings or big, customer bases. And price matters a lot. So it's not necessarily the same kind of world that it used to be. So that's, my two cents. And even in the automotive industry, actually. I mean, you look at some of the newer car manufacturers that are coming online that are really trying to undercut their rivals price-wise. And some of these are U.S.-built cars and some aren't.
Brad Fraser.
Yeah, so certainly also looking at just like the nature of competition, no one firm wants to be the first firm to raise prices.
Right.
So it is a good point that a lot of corporations are actually like smaller branches of a larger corporation. But still, if in these competitive markets, not one firm is looking to be the first guy to move, especially with the new tariffs. That's why maybe we are seeing a sort of lag effect of the tariffs, because these firms are concerned with losing demand due to this increase in price.
Yeah, you kind of just touched on it. The tariffs were what I wanted to get into. It's been, what, about 6 months since the initial implication of them in April? And you hadn't really, up until really recently, you hadn't really seen much of a price or a price spike. And like you just mentioned earlier, but I think that comes down to firms not wanting to be the first one to raise prices, as that's kind of one of their more competitive edges is their price. So I think prices aren't, it's hard for companies to increase prices quickly and stay competitive.
Except in the supermarket, prices are really high.
Yeah.
Well, the margins there are so slim.
Right. I was going to say
it's kind of crazy.
Yeah, I'm not blaming the supermarkets. Right. I'm just saying the packaging is smaller, so that's actually good for the environment. But you get less for what you're paying for, and you know, I see lots of families in the supermarket, like going to the checkout, looking at their basket, and putting stuff back.
So yeah. I also think, I mean, when you see small businesses apologizing for raising the price of a cup of coffee,
yeah,
that tells you something. That's not where they want to be. This is not about someone trying to clean up on profits.
When you think about big retailers, going back to the letter writer's original point, is that so when Walmart sells a T-shirt for $10, what they might be paying from their importer might only be a dollar for that T-shirt. So the tariff on that dollar is a drop in the bucket when they're retailing it for 10.
Right.
So big corporations can more easily afford that because they have monopoly. It's actually called monopsony power when there's a single buyer that's buying all of these things. So,
Students, anyway. Has that been on an exam?
First time
monopsony.
Here.
Okay.
All right. I'm done. I'm finished.
Okay. All right.
Mic drop.
Very impressive.
Yes.
Russ says the most significant of economic changes now approaching are the effects of the tax cuts. Large corporations are already lowering their provision for taxes by multiple billions. Wealthy individuals will soon be wealthier, and oddly, the elderly will soon have a reduced tax burden. Taxes won't change much for everyone else. So what will the C-suite denizens spend all this money on? Groceries? Asks Russ. Then we go to a Cold War question. I read a New York Times article many years ago that the Cold War was a lot like animal behavior, a lot of snarling and posturing, yet an animal behavior, and ours, no one actually gets killed. Where is this going? So it is actually a better place to be than killing each other. And as we are animals, it is, quote, what we do to keep from killing and being killed. They had some research behind that. I'm looking for the article now. Okay.
But I just have an image of a spooky Halloween cat with all his fur up. So that was kind of apropos to today.
Okay. All right.
Glad that's what you saw, because that's not what I saw.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
I was imagining my cat. He's very fat. But
I don't know if I agree with no one actually the line no one actually gets killed. But okay. Here we go to nuclear. Trump is something else. He heard Russia is testing nuclear delivery systems and misunderstood the actual event as testing of bombs. Let's see. Michael says, my understanding is that we agreed to stop nuclear testing because we don't have any technical need to do it, not because it is the right thing for humanity. Then Ross says, I have two questions. One, how come there hasn't been any conversation on the tariffs inflicted upon Canada this week that are retaliatory and not in America's best interest? We did talk about this last week, actually. Aaron, do you want to just touch on it real quick?
Because there's just so much to talk about that if we talked about every whimsy, like, you know, whether the tariffs imposed on Brazil because, you know, they're actually investigating the coup attempt, or the tariffs in Canada because of an unfavorable ad, or the, you know, tariffs on China because they're embargoing rare earth mineral exports. These are all illegal. Like, there's no legal basis for this, and it's clear the courts aren't going to be pursuing this, and the Supreme Court probably doesn't have a backbone to decide or to rule against it.
Okay.
I know that's a lot.
No, that's fine. Correct me if I'm wrong on the Canada tariffs. It was sort of
increased by 10% because of a TV ad.
Right. Right. And that was a Reagan TV ad.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So,
what are we getting from Canada? Like Molson and
lumber, aluminum, hydro.
Hockey.
A lot of
hockey. Yeah, a lot of hockey. All right. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up and we'll call it a show. We welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.
What's wrong with me? Why do I feel like this?
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We have a great group and we're talking about all kinds of things. I just want to know, I'm fascinated by this story out of England regarding King Charles stripping his brother Andrew of a prince title over the Epstein scandal. Why? How?
Why now?
Well, right. I just like it. Just seems to me like it's a you know, the death of a thousand cuts, and you know, they start off like this started off earlier this year of, well, we're not inviting you to Easter.
Mm-hmm.
And then they said we're taking away, this is true, they were taking away your driveway. And then it was, then you're not coming to Christmas. And then you're going to lose this. And then finally they got around to, we're stripping you of, you're now just Andy.
Well, I think it's because new information came out about his you know, behavior and that he's a sexual predator.
But that interview 5 years ago, like you couldn't get beyond that.
Yeah, I know. Mm-hmm. Look, I don't think the royal family is the epitome of good decision making.
I'm worried that you follow it so closely. Honestly, you know we're independent, right? Like, I'm just
no. I know we're independent. I will tell you, and it's a fair question, Heather. I'll answer it absolutely honestly. I teach an interviewing class, and the interview that he did, that Andy did with the now I can call him Andy, that he did with the BBC, I show as an example of singularly the worst interview. That
terrible,
like how bad a reporter can eviscerate you, and then even though you're a prince and think you have the world by the tail, you know, just shut up.
And also don't do the interview.
Well, right. Right. And the moments that he said, well, I don't know. I wouldn't exactly. I don't remember if. I don't know. I don't remember if we were clothed or not. I mean, it's just like, oh my God. So yeah. I do have an interest in it because I sort of have followed it from that lens. But I will say that but I also think it's interesting of how the royal family is dealing with it, whereas here we're just talking about, oh, should we discuss this? No, let's just resume nuclear testing.
Yeah. Well, I want to say, like, I always think it's fascinating how people are so obsessed with, like, royal weddings and all that stuff. And so my favorite South Park episode ever is the Canadian royal wedding. Oh, my gosh. I would just urge everyone, Google it. It's so funny. The Canadian royal wedding. And it's just a spoof of live TV coverage of the British royal weddings. But I wonder if there's not some health issues going on with the king, and that
he wants to wrap things up.
Getting
exactly.
The house.
That's, I mean, that is the vibe that I got from it. I mean, yeah. We're seeing a lot more stories on, Prince William, yeah, and you know, kind of glowy talk about their wedding, or you know, their marriage and the children and all this stuff. A lot more focus on them recently, and I just, to me, maybe I'm paranoid, but I think maybe there's some wrapping up of things going on, but I don't know.
You mentioned South Park. I just want to let our viewers know that if you were disappointed that Wednesday's episode did not air, what they did is they put it on hold, and the Halloween episode, which deals with the demolition of the East Wing of the White House, airs tonight.
Oh, it's going to be so good.
So, I just, programming note,
thank you for the
set
update.
Your DVRs. Yeah, okay. I want you all to get in on the South Park Halloween special.
Guaranteed to be profanity-laden and offensive. It's really awesome.
And if you haven't seen the earlier episodes of this season, you are missing something pretty special. Judith Enk, let me ask you about... volunteers stepping in to help Noah track Hurricane Melissa. You fire everybody. Then there's a federal shutdown. Then there's one of the biggest storms ever. And then you put out a sign going, oh, can you help us?
Yeah, it's a nightmare. I mean, not everyone knows what Noah does, but they're not only the weather people, but they track hurricanes. And it's not just that, but in this moment of climate change, we need as much advance notice for these disasters as possible. Just yesterday, there was major flooding in New York City. Two people died. If a couple of years ago someone had told me heavy rains, people die in New York City, I would not have believed it. But these NOAA cuts are terrible. I worked pretty closely with NOAA, not on the weather piece, but on the environmental protection piece. Most of those folks are gone. Well, if they're still there, they're furloughed right now. But the warmer weather makes the water temperature warmer. So a Category 3 hurricane becomes a Category 5 hurricane, like we just saw in Jamaica. You probably saw the massive flooding, unprecedented, in Vietnam. And to be cutting NOAA and asking for volunteers like you're a docent at the Troy Music Hall is just nuts.
And this comes as large staff increases came earlier from the Trump administration, having nothing to do with this particular case, just prior.
Staff increases?
Oh, staff decreases. Cuts. Yes,
yeah, yeah.
I apologize.
Yeah. This was all covered in Plan 2025. They want to get rid of NOAA, which is insane. I mean, your local weathercasters rely on federal satellites.
And they're starting to speak out about it, too, even on the air, of saying normally we would get this information from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and now we're not, which I think goes back to even an earlier topic, dealing with the economy of not getting the data that you need.
Yeah. It's amazing how much people say, the government's inefficient. The government does, you know, they're overstaffed. These bureaucrats. It's amazing how quickly they change their tune once they realize what it is those bureaucrats do and what those services provide. And we're going to find out with SNAP, the Affordable Care Act, the NOAA cuts, all of these things. People are going to start realizing, oh, maybe we do need stuff like that.
NOAA is mostly scientists, so that's why they're really going after them.
Right, because they because they know things.
Yeah. No more science.
Yes, I don't want any of that. So what do college students do on Halloween?
I work at a local pizza place, so it'll be a really busy night tonight.
Oh, all right. Excellent.
I'll just say I'm trick-or-treating tonight.
Excellent.
Trunk-or-treating?
Yeah, me as well. I will also be trick-or-treating tonight.
Costume choice?
Harry Potter.
Oh, good, oh, nice. good for you. And
I'm a medical patient. Yeah.
You know, I have a feeling trick or treating is a euphemism for something else, but I'm not gonna.
We're gonna leave it at trick or treating. Okay,
yeah. All right. Yeah.
That just went off in the rails.
No, I find it interesting.
Okay.
Yeah. So a patient, some sort of like a surgical patient.
Sort of. There's a little more to it, but
we'll leave it at that. All right.
Yeah, well, you know how when you go into surgery, there's like the open back on the thing you wear.
Oh, great.
Yeah, well, it's fake, but, you know, that's what it's getting at. That's
awesome. Aren't you happy you asked?
I wasn't going to say it.
So, okay. So you like, all your roommates are going to see your ass?
No, not actually.
I'm feeling
it's
unsafe
a fake.
Here.
It's a fake ass.
Okay. All right.
This has taken a turn.
You asked. I'm sorry.
I know. I did. You're absolutely right.
When I was at Albany Law, we had epic Halloween parties at the school, like at the school proper. And I don't know if anyone remembers this, but there was a whale that was stuck in the ice up in Alaska. That was the year I graduated. And like Russian, some freighter came over and broke them out of the ice.
Oh, that
but it
was nice.
Two whales stuck in the ice. And one of my friends went to the Halloween party as the whale stuck in the ice.
That's great.
It was really,
I like the current events costumes.
Yeah,
very nice. Very, very nice. Well, I wish you all good luck tonight. Thank you very much. I'm sorry you have to work, but otherwise you could be a medical patient. I thank you so much. You're wonderful, wonderful students. Bradley Frazier, Jake Nass, and Natalie Zhu, I wish you all the luck in the world. I do hope you come back and visit us. We'd love to have you back.
Thank you, Bradley.
Thank you very much.
Heather, thank you so much. Aaron, always a pleasure when you bring your students in. It's a delight and certainly a testament to your great work with them. Judith?
Everyone remember to vote this Tuesday.
There you go.
Or early voting.
Last words from Judith Inc. On that topic as we go up to a break here. We will continue with the third hour of the Roundtable. But first, this break and news. We'll be back right after this.